Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the beginning of the 3rd century AD, the writer Athenaeus of Naucratis wrote on his manuscript Dipnosophistai, which means philosophers at dinner, the following passage. But Archestratus, that writer so curious in all that relates to cookery, in his gastrology, speaks thus of the bonito. Towards the end of autumn, when the Pleiades has hidden its light, you can cook bonito, whatever way you please. Why need I teach you? For then you cannot spoil it, even if you wish. But if you should desire Moschus, my friend, to know by what recipe you best may cook it, take the green leaves of fig trees and fresh marjoram, but not too much, no cheese or other nonsense, but merely wrap it in the fig leaves and tie it around with a small piece of string. Then bury it beneath the glowing ashes, judging by instinct of the time it takes to be completely done without being burned. And if you wish have the best of their kind, take care to get them from Byzantium, or if they come from any sea near that, they'll not be bad. But if you go down lower and pass the straits into the Aegean Sea, they're quite a different thing, in flavor worse, as well as size, and merit far less praise. Who exactly was Archestratus? From literary fragments, just as the one I've read, I feel I want to know and understand the man and his motives, and learn everything about him. Of course, these questions about his life story had me puzzled for ages. I wanted to write an episode for a while now. But the more I looked for information about his life and works, the more unanswered questions I have had. And admittedly, countless classicists, historians, and food writers have been puzzled through the ages too, with the same burning questions. I'm Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. A podcast all about archaeogastronomy. On each episode, we examine the foods, recipes, ingredients, and their history from the ancient world, be it classical Greece, ancient Roman Empire, the Egyptian Kingdom, or Mesopotamia, or the glorious Persia. Or we examine legendary culinary figures from the past. And today, we're gonna see such a figure, the legendary Archestratus of Syracuse, the first foodie hero, the first foodie hipster of the ancient world, and of course, our modern world too. Okay, so let's give it a bit of a context here. Let's understand what we're dealing with. Imagine a friend, the worst foodie hipster friend you have. The one that visits the local farmer's market every weekend. The one that goes to Borough Market as if on a religious pilgrimage at least once a month. And also, on top of that, knows every single Vietnamese store in Hackney and all the South American food stalls in Seven Sisters Intermarket. He also seems to know the new food trends and all the new and trendy ingredients, and also reads the reviews on Eater for the cheapest eats at the outskirts of Southeast London for some reason. As if we'll ever visit Southeast. Anyway, well, your foodie friend has nothing going on compared to Archestratus, our subject today. If you thought your friend was annoying for visiting the Mercado de San Martín in San Sebastian, or San Miguel in Madrid, and La Boqueria Market in Barcelona, or the Mercato delle Embre in Bologna, or the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul, or the Varvakios Market in Athens, spending hours looking at fish that cannot buy, well, you know the friend I mean, right? The one who watched all the episodes of Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown, and can quote all his lines. Well, our dude Archestratus was a lot worse. New tastes, the freshest ingredients, so local and seasonal and simple that even the inhabitants of the nearest town wouldn't have heard them. Well, Archestratus would have been there first, straight to the local fishermen, begging them for fish. The world's first gourmand. The hipster foodie traveler, the tourist who went to every food market on every city he visited. Only he accomplished your feat 2,500 years ago, and all by sail. Firstly, let's go back. Let's rewind and lose ourselves in the Hellenic world of 450 BCE. When one thinks of classical ancient Greece, philosophy, democracy, theatre, architecture and the amazing temples is what normally springs to mind, and not cookery books. Certainly, Greek culture and the food style of the period, alongside with the famous symposiums, fascinated academics and foodies alike throughout the centuries. But beyond that, we don't know much of that part of their culture when we know so much more for about everything else. Especially considering that we have elevated food culture into such a status in our modern world. It's ubiquitous across our TVs and our magazines and everywhere else. So today, in this episode, I would like to try and address this a little bit and bring some much-needed balance. The ancient Greek world of the 5th century BCE was vast. For the standards of the time, encompassed numerous sites across the continent of Europe, in the Balkans and around the Black Sea, South Italy and Sicily, the coast of France and the coast of Spain, alongside North Africa, the Middle East. Generally, you get the idea, all over the Mediterranean and the Black Seas. It stretched beyond the limits of modern Greece, which seems small by comparison. And I don't mean here by actual size, which would be obvious, the obvious way. Let's not forget here that Greek colonies were small city-states, controlling a limited amount of coastal land and perhaps some farms and some farmland around it. But more importantly, the ancient Greek world was much bigger in a way that incorporated a multitude of landscapes, climates, peoples, tribes. Ancient Greeks were cosmopolitans, with influences drawn from a wide Mediterranean background, taking in a diversity and a medley of ideas, unrestricted by the topography of their Hellenic mainland. Travel seems to have always been held in high regard, which is no surprise for peoples rather renowned for their curiosity and innovation. Many tales and myths, such as Jason and the Golden Fleece, celebrated the benefits to be gained from traveling. Travel could be an expensive business, and of course hospitality was usually provided by social peers for free, at least for the higher classes. In such a world, it's not a surprise that ingredients, flavors, techniques all blended together to excite the upper class citizens and scandalize the philosophers who moralized or lamented the good old days. All this luxury had the rich merchant class and the influential citizens of 400 BCE antagonize and outcompete each other as to whom would host the most brilliant symposium. This was the one main meal of the day, which started early in the evening. Drinking and talking went through the night, as well as music and poetry and sex sometimes, which was part of the good all-nighter. Men reclined on couches, each with a small table. A host would often hire a cook and waiters for the occasion. We see these Greeks grew rich and wealthy from trading with Egypt, Asia, Carthage, and were accustomed with a luxurious lifestyle, which was frowned upon back in the philosophy schools of Athens. I will post some maps and some pictures of ancient Greek sites and cities across the Mediterranean, especially the main big ones, so you can see where the trade was happening. And I'll post all this on my Twitter and Patreon page. I will also post some links about the ancient trade in the Mediterranean world and the wider context in order to understand the trips of Archestratus. As an example of the vast trade networks that existed, consider the following passage from an ancient comedy showing off the trade that was happening in the port of Piraeus in Athens. Silphium and ox hide from Cyrene, from Hellespont, mackerel and every salt fish, from Thessaly, porridge and ox ribs, the Syracusans send us pigs and cheese, eels from Rhegium, incense from Syria, cypress wood from Crete. Africa has ivory and Rhodes has dreamy raisins and figs. From Euboea come pears and fat apples. Slaves from Phrygia. The Paphlagonians send chestnuts and glossy almonds. Phoenicia provides wheat and dates. Carthage sends rugs and fancy pillows. Alongside the trade in foods and other commodities, people travel too. And usually voluntary, to find a living. That includes cooks, for Syrian bakers and Sicilian chefs were already widely sought after. In this interconnected world of the ancient Med, we find Archestratus then, a Sicilian who circumnavigated the world to satisfy his hunger. And even lower appetites, as a Roman scholar said once quite disparagingly. He was, though, an inveterate traveller. How else could he have found out about the specialties of all these places, of all these small seaside cities, over 50 of them, from Sicily to the Black Sea? And remarkably, what he writes rings true, as sometimes their specialties are exactly the same now as they were 2,400 years ago. Which in itself is incredible, to be honest. Other specialties, of course, changed by time. And in Archestratus, we see his love for the lesbian wine, for the taste of lesbian wine, and his praise for the aroma of the Phoenician wine that came from Byblos in modern-day Lebanon. Places that they were really, really famous for the wine in the ancient world. And we know it from other writers and travellers that it produced a great quality of wine. We find the following passage on Athenaeus, quoting Archestratus. When a libation to the gods you make, let your wine worthy be, and ripe, and old, whose hoary locks droop his purple lake, such as in Lesbos' secret isle is sold. Phoenicia doth a generous liquor bear, but still the lesbian I would rather quaff, for though through age the former rich appear, you'll find its fragrance will with use go off. We know almost nothing about Archestratus, to be honest. We're clutching straws here. aside from that he was a Sicilian Greek from Yela, a town in the eastern coast of Sicily, or Syracuse, which was one of the biggest, most important Greek colonies and also a dependent city-state in the ancient world. Syracuse is best known as the city of Archimedes, the famous Greek mathematician and inventor. It is located in the southeast corner of the island of Sicily. Originally, it was settled about 734 BCE by Corinthians, led by the aristocrat Archias. The nucleus of the settlement was the small island of Ortygia. There, and around the mainland, the settlers found the land fertile. The island itself had natural harbors and spring water, so the city flourished and in turn founded new colonies, and all in all, grew rich, prosperous, and powerful. Eventually, the aristocratic elite was ousted and democracy was established, led by Hippocrates. With the defeat of the Carthaginians at the Battle of Himera at 480 BCE, he brought a period of peace which brought a golden age for Syracuse. The city gained a reputation as a cultural center, and literary greats as Aeschylus and Simonides and Pindar all spent time there. At the time, it was considered as one of the biggest and most important Greek cities. The walls enclosed an area of 300 acres at least, and the population of the city and the surrounding areas was approximately 250,000, and it rivaled the population of Athens. But Archestratus, all that he wrote, is now lost. But we know he had a remarkable and unique poem called The Life of Luxury, or Hidipathia. The poem is dated at around 300 BCE. And what we know of the poem is mostly from Athenaeus, from his work Dipnosophistae, or Philosophers at Dinner, which was composed in about AD 200. As this is our only source for Archestratus' work, this in itself is telling. There are many lost works of ancient literature, poetry, drama, and so on. And these, they are usually referenced and quoted by multiple ancient authors. However, this lack of interest demonstrates the status of food and recipe books. They weren't high literature, and therefore they weren't carefully preserved for posterity, unfortunately for us. I'd probably give my right arm for the chance to glance upon the book of On Bread Making by Chrysippus of Tyana, or read the book on salt fish by Euthydemus of Athens. Sadly, both are lost in the mists of time and only known through second-hand passing accounts from other authors. So as we see, most all of cookery books from ancient Greece are lost, they don't exist. What's happening here with Archestratus is that The Life of Luxury was written in verse. It was a poem, after all. Which, firstly, it gives us reason to believe that it was a heard literature, so that is something that is recited to and associated with upper-class citizens and their banquets and symposiums. It was not a hand-on cookery book, like a manual or a cookery book nowadays, an instruction manual for the kitchen. And as such, we generally see a contrast between Archestratus' advice for good and elegant living and the grinding hard work of the peasant in Hesiod's Works and Days. Hesiod was an ancient Greek poet, active between 750 and 650 BCE. He was one of the earliest Greek poets, often called the father of didactic poetry. The father of history Herodotus credits him and Homer with giving the Greeks their gods. Hesiod's Works and Days is a didactic poem At its center is a farmer's almanac, in which Hesiod instructs his brother in the agricultural arts, with extensive moralizing advice on how he should live his life. It is best known for its origin of the toil and pain that define the human condition. From the fragments of life of luxury we have, it seems it was mimicking Hesiod's works and days, but in a very playful, funny and entertaining way for the symposiums of the upper classes. And this playfulness is what probably caught the eye of Athenaeus and seduced him to quote Archestratus into 62 passages, the fragments that survive with us to this day. Now contrast this with the fate of Mithaikos, who was an influential cook of the ancient world, influential enough to outrage Plato, the most famous of philosophers. But because he wrote in prose, he isn't mentioned or quoted much in the ancient world, so we have nothing of his works, again, surviving to our modern age. From these few fragments, we can presume that Archestratus was not a lowly chef, since chefs were unlikely to be sufficiently educated to write an epic-style poem. He had, though, knowledge of quality produce and combinations of flavors and use of heat in cooking, and certainly used this knowledge, alongside with his vast and numerous travels, to get the freshest ingredients so he can compose his poem for both learning and entertaining purposes. As I mentioned before, the cook was a low-status job. Nevertheless, the best chefs operated in a competitive mode, being hired out together with a brigade of assistants to the home of the rich, who in turn they were competing with each other. Quality and fame mattered to chefs. Consider the following fragment from an Athenian comedy of the 4th century BC of the playwright Dionysius, which is called The Lawmaker. "Anyone can prepare dishes, carve meat, boil up sauces, and blow on the fire. Even a mere commis. But the chef is something else. To understand the place, the season, the man giving the meal, the guest, and what fish to buy, that is not a job for just anyone." It certainly rings true today, and it seems to have been the way the chefs thought of themselves back then too. Don't you recognize certain chefs on this passage? Comedy might is, but it's an appropriate place for food and cooking to be commented upon. After all, cooking is entertainment too. Even more so today. Television is awash with food programs. You can see the comedy. You can understand it if you have watched any of the zillion of food programs on TV. For example, the cooking program MasterChef. When the contestants toil away and cut themselves and burn themselves, and they go to a restaurant for some professional experience, and they get all messy and the burnt food and so on. Or if you watched Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, for example. I mean, it's hilarious what's happening there. Life of a cook in a kitchen is always on the verge of comic, and must have been true in the ancient world too. You see, all the complex and all the menial skills are combined, and there's a sharp contrast between the heat of the kitchen, in both literal and metaphorical sense, and the calm of the banquet where the food is presented. And that was always ripe for mocking. So what else do we find on these 62 fragments of Archestratus' poem? We can deduct that he's concentrated a lot on fish cooking. Fish was more highly valued by chefs than meat, because meat was closely associated with other rituals, rituals of worship and sacrifice. So Greek culture associated fish eating, quality fish as opposed to small fry, with luxury, and meat eating with gods. Which, if you consider it, if you think about it, comes to a stark contrast with the later Christian Europe, where feast is reserved for fast days. Archestratus cooks the fish simply, boiling, roasting, or grilling with light seasoning and oil added if it's a quality fish. Freshness and quality are his watchwords. And these features mustn't be damaged by strong sauces based on cheese and pungent herbs. His favorite fish tend to have firm textured and strongly flavored meat, rather than the mild tasting flesh like the white fish we are now used in French cooking as a vehicle for the sauces. He also shows much interest in eels, common, conger, and Murray. He emphasizes flavor and the oil fat content of the fish, where the taste and interest is to be found. There is much interest also in the texture of the fish, the different cuts and parts from head meat, fin, tail, and especially belly, as well as in the varieties of fish. There's a striking resemblance here on his approach and the traditional fish dishes of the Basque country, which I find very, very interesting and heartening. Later on the program, we'll touch on some of Archestratus' fish recipes. Here I want to emphasize also his presentation of fish has something in common with the Chinese approach as described in the modern manual of Yan Kit Shou, classic Chinese cookbook. Yan Kit, she was an incredible food historian and cookery expert. This comparison I do here, and many experts have done before me, with the Far Eastern cuisine are very appropriate. There's a holistic approach to mealtime, with emphasis on the balance, which is common to both cuisines. So China, we have yin and yang. In ancient Greece, in the ancient world, we had the humors. The four humors, blood, phlegm, black and yellow bile, were to be kept in the right proportion and quality. Hot, cold, wet and dry. And you do this by eating foods that would provide that balance and the required qualities. Also, another comparison I want to make here is the cooking of Archestratus is not sauce-based, and this is striking and to be contrasted with the strong flavors added to Roman foods. What we know through our main source of ancient Roman food from Apicius, as we've seen on the previous episode of the podcast, it was full of strong flavors and rich sauces and lots of herbs and ingredients, which of course tastes nice and is great, but compare and contrast Apicius with Archestratus, we have completely the opposite approach. Stronger flavors, though, were recommended at the beginning and the end of the meal, and that was in the forms of olives, barley breads, small birds, and pickled sow's womb. In Archestratus, meats are prepared with equal simplicity and an eye to the essential juices. Some places that we know of his fragments that he recommends particular dishes. So we have Toroni in South Italy, which was Magna Graecia in the ancient world. He's recommending shark belly steaks. In Olynthus, which is in modern day Greece in Chalkidiki, he recommends grayfish. In Eresus, which is in Lesbos Island, he recommends the barley, has the best barley for bread, and of course the wine. From Byzantium, which is modern-day Istanbul, he recommends the fish bonito. In Thessaly, central Greece, he comments upon the emmer bread rolls, so breads made from emmer wheat. In ancient Phoenicia, in Byblos, where today is modern Lebanon, the wine. In Carthage, he recommends bream. From Lake Copais, in modern-day central Greece, eels. From the island of Samos, tuna. From the seas of the northern Sicily, tuna again. Here I would like to narrate a little made-up story, thinking how Archestratus would have gone by on his various trips around the Mediterranean on finding the best fish and the best ingredients for his book. So bear with me with this little fantasy of mine.
"2 weeks," said the captain, "these trips of yours will take,"
spitted to Archestratus. "2 weeks each way," Archestratus replied to the fat man. The man who accompanied Archestratus on this latest expedition of his, unwillingly to both of course, was a merchant of hides, skins and leather goods. A rather seedy looking fat man, scouring for new markets in Scythia to sell his produce. An inexperienced landlubber, in other words, who was now finally ashore again. As was he disembarking, he embraced the captain, he embraced Archestratus and the rest of the crew. He hurried out of the boat, kneeled clumsily initially, then fell on the floor and lied belly down, stretching to cover the whole paved marina in front of him, where the crew and the baggage porters were supposed to unload the ship, grateful to reach homeland again, alive and in one piece. They've been out at sea, on board of the flat-bottomed, round-hulled, sail-powered holkas, which is a type of ancient Greek cargo ship, a sturdy vessel with large drafts, for the best part of 80 days. Well, aside from the nights that they had spent in seaside market towns, of course. And the trip took so long because Archestratus had other ideas. He knew 2 weeks were near enough the time he needed to discover and taste what eluded him in the previous trips to the Black Sea. The captain of the merchant vessel, Eutychia, which means good luck, was easily persuaded to change course due to his love for silver. And the merchant needed and wanted new markets and new customers, so it was in his interest to follow regardless. What Archestratus' main concern was is that he wanted to eat the freshest local fish in each town they stopped, the delicious specialty that the new spring had brought to the coastal seas. What the local fishermen caught, and all before they were salted or pickled or made into garum. Archestratus wanted only the best in its simplest, purest form. That meant stopping numerous times along the route towards their final destination. That was the important Greek city of Phanagoria, strategically placed on the opening of Myotis Lake, nowadays the Azov Sea, where it meets the Black Sea on the Cimmerian Bosporus, where the numerous tribes of Scythians live. That was the interest of the merchant, the Scythians. They had gold and boundless wheat, and even more horses than grains of sand. Surely, they would be the ideal market for his leather goods. For our ancient hipster hero, the only goal in sight was the fresh fish of the town and the famous garum they produced. But Phanagoria and her goods had to wait. Firstly, they've stopped on the island of Euboea, at the town of Halkis, where the strong current of the strait made her famous for her fresh fish. Then, at the island of Lesbos, for some vintage wine, equal to ambrosia that the gods drink according to some. Then a stop to Byzantium for some bonito, with a further stop at Sinope, a Greek colony in Pontus, the southern part of Black Sea, modern-day Turkey. 80 whole days to return to Syracuse in Sicily. Archestratus, though, didn't share the merchant's enthusiasm for reaching home. Already in his mind, he was planning the next gastronomic adventure for his forthcoming book about cookery, called, well, he hasn't decided the title yet. Maybe Gastrology or Gastronomy. Anyway, he was planning his next adventure to the Carthaginian colony of Gadis, or Gadir, modern-day Cadiz. Beyond the edge of the known world, really. Beyond the pillars of Hercules. What fresh produce will he find there? Their incredible garum was already legendary. 12 pints of the garum there cost the equivalent of 950 kilos of wheat, or 2,000 loaves of bread. And Archestratus couldn't wait to taste the fresh migrating Atlantic tuna. According to rumors, it was huge there, as big as a bull. That was the next trip. But what about the year after? The next summer, well, he was planning to hire a trading boat, all to himself this time. No greedy merchants. With its own crew and captain, and spent the whole season, 5 months, doing the length of the Mediterranean Sea. Circumnavigated it from one end to the other, stopping on all the Greek cities, but also the Carthaginian ones, Etruscan and Egyptians too. That would be the most ambitious gastronomic voyage yet, that no one else had dared to accomplish. So devoted to luxury he was, that needed to seek out very carefully, with great diligence, whatever related to his stomach. So he can write with the greatest accuracy, where every kind of edible is to be tasted from, at the right time, in the greatest perfection. But all this had to wait next year. Maybe, when this is done, he can retell his adventures, perhaps as an epic poem, on the style of Homer or Hesiod. That would be an appropriate way to narrate it to the King of Syracuse next autumn. What unknown pleasures await. So where does this leave us now? After a whole episode about the first ever hipster foodie gourmet, do we know more about Echestratus after this long speculating about his life and work? What's for sure is that his gastronomic rules were simple, and in a sense ring as true today as they were 2,500 years ago. Good quality of raw ingredients, harmonic combination of these said ingredients, light sauces, moderation in spices, no heavy sauces with spicy ingredients. And most importantly, the essence of a good company with every meal. A few good friends to share nature's bounty with. 3, maybe 4 friends around the table, no more. Okay, I think it's time for this Archestratus recipes I promised you earlier on in the show. Generally speaking, the recipes here that are of interest are quite simple to make. I'll start with the meat one, and actually it's the only meat one that I've got for you. It calls for roast hare. According to Archestratus, the best way to eat it is hot, on the spit, sprinkled with a bit of sea salt. One of the recipes has a little bit of an interesting sauce coming with it. And this one is made with sautéed onions. So finely chop one onion, sauté it in olive oil. Season that with a bit of savory, a bit of rue, and a bit of celery seed, and asafoetida. And if you want to find more about the herbs that I'm mentioning above, where is rue from, what is it, and asafoetida, and about savory and so on, check my episode about the herbs and the spices from the ancient world. That was the episode about the silphium. So, we sauté the onion, we season it with the herbs, and then we add red wine, about half a glass, and some fish sauce, according to taste, and a little olive oil. We reduce it, we carve the meat, which in this occasion is our roasted hare, and we serve it with a bit of sauce on the side. Another simple recipe from one of the fragments of Archestratus is the following that calls for bonito, wrapped in fig leaves, lightly seasoned with oregano, and then you bake it. Once you tie the fig leaves with some string, you bake it under hot ashes. The advice is here, don't overcook it, and basically just add some green olive oil at the end. Very, very simple. Another recipe is sea bream in cheese and oil, which sounds very weird, and it goes against all advice we've had from Archestratus so far, which is was simple sauces, no cheeses, and so on. Well, this one calls for a bream, which you make a crust with cheese, a bit of olive oil, and cumin, and some white wine vinegar. So in a sense, you create lots of hardship cheese. So for example, something like a pecorino sardo, you grate it, you mix it with a bit of olive oil, cumin, as much or as little as you find acceptable. So if you like the taste of cumin, yeah, just go for it by all means. And then a bit of white wine vinegar. This mix, apply it with your hands and make it all, so all the ingredients bind together. You'll make a paste and you can spread it on the fish, on the flesh of the fish or the skin of the fish. So cover it both sides. So I get a whole sea bream, which is normally these sea breams are about 500 grams, and tell the fishmonger to clean it. So you keep the head, you have the guts out, you season the guts inside with a bit of cumin and salt, and then you wrap it on this cheese paste that you made, both sides, leaving the head out. And then you bake it in a really hot oven for about 10 to 12 minutes. Hopefully without this crust running and melting away from the fish. It's a very tricky thing and needs a bit of attention and some experimentation, really. Make it a few times to see how it can stay together. It's very difficult. I will post this recipe and my tips analytically on Patreon for you to see. Another delicious recipe that I made recently, and it's quite easy actually. This one calls for Toronian tuna. So Toroni was an ancient Greek settlement colony in the south of Italy. And this recipe calls for tuna from Toroni, and basically mix it with you're making a sort of crust with herbs, with fresh chopped herbs, a bit of cumin, and then you simply bake it, and then you sprinkle a bit of green olive oil and some vinegar, and you serve it with a salad, with a fresh green salad. So I take the fillet of tuna, and I finally chop some herbs, whatever I have in hand. So let's say parsley, fresh coriander, fresh mint, maybe some celery leaf. So I take all this, I chop them finely, I mix them with a bit of breadcrumbs and a few sea salt flakes. And then I add some cumin, not cumin seeds, but cumin powder. So I make this sort of crust, sort of fresh herb crust. I press it on the fish steak, on the tuna steak. And then I bake it in the oven for, again, 10 minutes or so. Then simply sprinkle with a bit of vinegar, white wine vinegar, since the ancients didn't have lemon. So I put some nice white wine vinegar and then serve it with a nice green salad. Again, this is going to be another recipe which I'm going to post very soon on my Patreon page for you to see. The passage from the fragment we have in Athenaeus about the bream in cheese and oil goes like this. Bake bream at seaside Carthage. First, rinse it well. You will see a good big one in Byzantium too, with a body the size of a round shield. Deal with it whole. When you have taken it and coat it well, all over with cheese and oil, hang it in a hot clay oven and then bake it through. Sprinkle with cumin rubbed salt and grey-green oil, drenching it generously with a divine liquid. And that's it. I hope I gave you some inspiration. And for more information, stay tuned and keep checking my Patreon page. I hope Archestratus' trips and gastronomic adventures then weren't in vain. Although nothing survived of his life and works but a few fragments, I would like to think that his legend is very much alive, and his pilgrimage pretty much picked up again in our modern age by countless passionate people who I may call foodie hipsters in zest, of course, but in true style, they are the worthy successors of the father of gastronomy. After all, why else you'd travel far and wide to try all these exciting morsels of mouthgasms and get to a fish market to check the produce, if not subconsciously weren't invoking the spirit of Archestratus? I want to end here saying that if there is a place and a people that Archestratus' spirit survives intact, I think I have to nominate the Basque people. Most notably, in and around San Sebastian. Their whole raison d'être is food. To eat delicious food, to have the taste of the freshest local produce in their mouth day in, day out. the passion which they exhibit on their choice of the regional ingredients, the seasonality and the genius of the simplicity in which the produce is cooked, no heavy sauces, no millions of herbs and spices either, bears striking similarity with Archestratus' principles. I rarely met people so committed to the quality of their food as the Basque are. Thank you for listening. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, you'll find the rest of the series on Acast, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and everywhere else you get your podcasts from. I would like to ask for your help, as little or as much as you can, and donate kindly on my Patreon page, called The Delicious Legacy there, so you can help me create the podcast more often and dedicate my time for more research, and of course get it out to you quicker and with lots and lots of perks and extras. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.